Hello.
Hi.
Welcome.
Welcome.
This is Pat.
And this is Garrett.
We are two-fifths of a band called The Maine from Phoenix, Arizona.
That we are.
And we are currently podcasting.
This is a podcast.
Yes. We're hanging at home recording some acoustic music at the moment. We kind of are done with the instrumentation.
Yeah, we just finished.
Like just now.
I need food because my brain feels like a crazy person.
So this week on the podcast is Johnny Minardi, who is a good friend of ours and has been for quite a long time.
A decade.
A decade, yes. If you do not know anything about him, he has probably been involved with one of your favorite bands. He worked for Field by Ramen for a long time and then Equal Vision, and now he's back to Field by Ramen. But he signed tons of great bands, and we talk about stories about
The Academy Is
when the Panic of the Disco album was like exploding, and he had to make very important decisions for it while the owner of the record label was out of town.
Yeah, it's a fun convo on the insides of the record label business.
Yeah, and then
we talk about
him trying to get our band on Field by Ramen and us not doing it.
Yep.
So there's some good talk about that and kind of what our headspace was at the time with all that. So
yeah, it was good times.
Yeah, he also owns a clothing line called Good Future Club, and if you go to goodfutureclub.com and use the code 8123, like the numbers, you can get 20% off everything and anything.
Beanies, hats, shirts, yes. Hoodies.
Yeah, they have very positive messages, and you know, just on the blog and in general, I think he's a very inspirational dude and really cares and wants people to do good in the world. So go support him.
Johnny, baby.
Yeah. So we will get into the chat here, and we hope you enjoy it.
Have fun. Later.
How are things going? You just getting back in town this weekend, or?
Yeah, I was in New York for a couple of days last week, so now just kind of digging back in.
Is it freezing? It was super cold, right?
Yeah, New York was cold and snowing, which I haven't seen in a while. So it was a little strange. I had to dig out a winter coat to head over there, but but I still had one, so I found it, and now I'm back in California, and it's 60s and 70s every day, so it's gorgeous.
Yeah. Nice. Very cool. Yeah, I was. Me and Garrett were just talking about looking back. I was looking through your Wikipedia earlier, and I was like, oh, I didn't realize.
I didn't even know I had a Wikipedia.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
Cool.
I didn't.
It's
I didn't,
probably all lies, but
yeah. You guys just started it for this.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I just didn't realize how many bands you had signed before. Like on your first record label, you know, like the Academy Is and Gatsby's, and just like, and that was all out of high school.
Yeah, I was 19, so it was like a year
Holy
removed
shit.
Or so. I mean, those bands I've probably signed when I was like 19 or 20. Probably 20 for those, because that was the latter year and a half of the label. But yeah, that was awesome. I also worked with Hidden in Plain View, who went on to Drive Thru, was awesome as well. Great band, good guys.
Oh yeah.
So what year was what around? What year was that?
So what did I do? LLR was 2001 to 2004. So I was 18 when I started, and then 21 when I ended.
Oh wow. So. Did you ever were you in a band ever, or were you just always into like the business side?
I was in a band, and it was yes. awful and amazing, as most one and done band members are. The band name might be in the Hall of Fame of worst band names ever. So it was White Suburban Trash and the Big Booze.
So it kept going. I thought, oh wow.
Yeah, yeah. There's, I think sometimes we put that in parentheses, but I think sometimes it was just there. So strong moves.
Was it ska? It kind of sounds ska.
No, dude. I played a 7-string Ibanez. Like, it
was, shit!
Yeah, it was good. I got some photos. I'll send you some photos.
Cool. Yeah.
That's
yeah,
like
I played two or three. I think two shows really is what you can count it as. But awesome. We recorded our first practice and released it on cassette to kids at school. So if it tells you how smart we were.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, it's like your like first like band name and any bands are always so bad.
Oh yeah. What were your guys though?
We are called the Kerosene Kids.
Yeah.
That's great. That would still work today. What do you mean?
But we weren't pyro, so we were lying.
Yeah, true. You were looking cool.
Yeah. We're into fire. No, I don't know. I don't really like fire.
That's great.
We'll have to send you that. We have a guy who actually did our the Main's first EP actually recorded that too. So
that's great.
We'll have to send it your way, and you can hear that.
Yeah, we'll trade incredible music after this.
So like what kind of then, got you into the business end of things and like wanting to do a record label? Cause during that time, you know, like now to start a record label is like pretty easy. You just have to have like a TuneCore account and you can just like, you know, like upload bands music and you can record them on your laptop. But you know, back then, I mean, like, that was a reach for you to, like, have a record label. I mean, like, you had to figure out your, like, distribution, and, I mean, it was just, like, such a different time.
Yeah. I mean, it was absolutely wild, but I think it worked for me at the time because I was very naive and didn't know anything, so it wasn't, like, this big daunting task because I didn't understand it. Basically, when I started, I was, like, 13 or 14, and I loved just, like, street teaming. And I'd reach out to every label, just like whatever contact forms or email addresses, or there were street team sites and stuff too, to where you could just sign up and they'd put you on like five of them or something. So I was always kind of like spreading music throughout like my schools or friend groups. And, you know, we'd be skateboarding and I'd get a box of stickers or, you know, Newfound Glory samplers or whatever it was at the time. And just kind of always was doing that and just telling, I was always kind of just like, I like this music a lot. I bet other people would too. You know, it was a very simple mentality. Mm-hmm. So when it came to the local scene, when I actually got introduced to like going to shows where there was only like 15, 20 people and like, oh, weird, like kids that go to high school with play shows, because, you know, it's a weird understanding going to see like Smashing Pumpkins play to 5,000 people. And then like your friend is in a band and you're like, what do you mean? Oh, where are you playing? And they're like at this bowling alley and you're like, oh,
yeah,
cool. So you're like, it's a really interesting mind switch. And then I was doing that, but I really liked the bands that were playing in those little shitty shows and no one was going to them. But I was like, I bet other people would like this a lot. Just no one's heard of it. So I kind of approached a couple of the bands that I was not even that close with yet. And I just said like, why aren't your CDs in stores? Or like, I didn't understand, you know what I mean? Like the whole business side. So I asked and they're like, they kind of would all laugh and be like, oh, that's hilarious, kid. You know what I mean? And I'm like, well, like I'll put it out, I'll get it in stores. And they're like, what do you mean? I'm like, I don't know, but I'll figure it out.
I mean, that's what's so crazy. I mean, because when we were like first starting out in bands, it was like anybody that came to you, like what we had multiple like people that was like the like guy that was like an intern at like the radio's like station in town was like, I have a record label, like I can sign you, and you're just like, you have no options at that time,
right?
So like, you just,
well, and everything just seems better than what you're doing. Like, if someone's like, I have a label, you're like, okay, cool, I'm down.
Yeah. Immediately stoked.
Yeah. You're like, oh, you could help me in any way because I'm 17 or 16 and I don't know what's going on.
Yeah. And it's, you know, sometimes it's easy to like now, especially, but it's easy to kind of just ask around and be like, is this person reputable? Have they ever done this before? Like whatever. But that first signing, it took me, I got turned down by like a couple bands, you know, and obviously rightfully so. I mean, I wasn't really like throwing huge money around or I didn't have any proof of concept. I was just like, I love your band. And I'll make sure other people that I think will love it will hear it. It's that's my concept. And, you know, luckily I ponied up a couple bucks to get a couple bands and they started believing and it kind of started working and evolved into, you know, what we spoke about with Academy Is and Gatsby's American Dream and stuff. So I got very lucky, but at the same time, just like, was like, fuck it, I'll figure it out. And I kind of did and kind of didn't at the same time, but but learned a lot along the way.
Yeah. So was the Academy Is kind of the first one to really get things going, or?
It's a weird path, because so the first record I ever put out was this band called August Premiere, who actually went on to sign to Feel by Ramen, but no one even really knows that. They're from Chicago, and they're actually the ones that turned the owner of Feel by Ramen onto Fall Out Boy, because they were playing so many shows. So yeah, it was kind of interesting. I put out that record, and I think they broke up like shortly after the Feel by record, so it didn't really go anywhere fast. But the first like record that I couldn't keep in stock, which at those times was, you know, really easy, because I was pressing 1,000 or 2,000 copies, yeah, and people were ordering like one a week. You know what I mean? So you got supply forever. But the first one ever was Remember Maine, which was William Beckett's solo acoustic project before Academy Is. And a friend of mine was just super close with him and like, hey, you got to hear this kid. And, you know, when people, it was like right when Dashboard was really big and Bright Eyes and all that kind of stuff. And he was just like this young high school kid. And I just was like, yeah, there's something really, really interesting happening. And kids are obviously reacting. So I became closer with him. And when I put that out, like, I would like refresh the Smart Punk and Interpunk charts like daily, and we would be like moving up, you know what I mean? And just be like,
I remember those days.
Yeah. And it was so fun, cause people would literally discover music off those. Cause you would check it and be like, oh, I've never heard of this band that's on the other side of the country. And you would literally be able to pay $3.99 and get their record, you know?
Yeah.
And it was a lot less noisy too. So it was like some of those charts you just sort of trusted.
I mean, like for us, like the unsigned chart on MySpace and on Smart Punk were, you know, some of the biggest, you know, reasons that we started having like success really early.
Absolutely.
And it was,
well, because you would see it and you'd be like, oh, if this band's up near the top, I have to at least check it out, like,
right,
you know, and like it's probably at least decently
a reason
good
why it's
like
happening,
that's yeah. How I heard Fall Out Boy the first time, they were on the they were like the first band on Pure Volume to hit like a million plays or something,
and
crazy. I was like what am I missing here, like I gotta listen to this, and that's when I heard it the first time,
right?
But back when charts mattered, I guess.
Yeah, when like I said I think there's just a lot less noise, and there was a lot harder to game that kind of system, you know what I mean? So you couldn't just like send a social media following towards something and vote on it or something. It was like actual purchases that people were just like, you'd watch and be like, there's so many Southern California bands that I've still never seen but live, but like they were in so many charts back then that I was like, they got to be the biggest band in the world, you know what I mean? And legitimately never signed to a label, but probably sold a couple thousand copies of their record through that site. So yeah, so that was kind of the first one, Remember Maine, and just had like great internet web store presence, and it was working. And then right after that was Hidden in Plain View, then Gatsby's American Dream, and Academy Is at the same time, basically.
Holy shit.
And those were our final two releases, because from there, that's when I left, and we kind of ended the label.
Yeah. I think the cool thing is like when you were doing that label, you know, I think like people might have this idea of like, you know, a guy that works at a record label, and it kind of being very different than the lifestyle of someone in a band, you know, where you're, you know, you're writing in a shitty van and you're sleeping on floors and you're doing all this stuff. But I, you know, kind of get the idea that that's the approach that you had with the record label. I mean, and even as you got like further along into your career, it's like you were always the guy that was like, you would go on tour with the bands. You would, you know, like sleep in the van and in crappy hotels. And was that kind of, did you feel like connected to the music scene at the time? So you were just doing like anything you could to be a part of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And before even the record label, like the transition from like street teaming and not understanding what a scene was into then seeing the same bands pal around and play together. Like I would go to those shows and start to be known as like the dude that would just be like, yo, do you need any help? I'll sell your merch. I'll help you load in. Like literally the most minute things without being annoying, like, yeah. Everything in that world, I was just that guy. And I mean, the first couple records I put out, like, it was my life. Like, I worked at a record store, so I would just take like a month off and go on the road with the band and help. I would sell their merch and tour manage and just make sure that every dollar they had stayed in their pockets, you know, or they lost less money, I should say, yeah. on the first runs, because dollars weren't in the pocket to begin with. But it really helped me understand that. And I think that that's one of the things that even now, which is crazy to say, it's almost 20 years later, it's like 18 years later, it's like I understand that. And one of my first things when I speak to new bands is always like, look, I get it, like, you're the one sleeping on floors, I'm not, like, all this shit, but like, I do understand there, those yeah. moments. I can absolutely, you know, there's tornadoes in Oklahoma City on my first day of my first tour ever that was like, holy shit, you guys have to go through this all the time. Like, this is really normal for you to have to figure out, you know, in a new place, how to duck and cover for a natural disaster, like really yeah. extreme circumstances. But, you know, that was a great eye-opening experience. When I'm bugging someone, like even making records today, it's like I'm bugging someone to send me over their lyrics or an updated verse or whatever. And I'm like, sometimes it's like, you got to just understand the two-way street of like other stuff. But I loved those times. And I still, like you said, even when I was working with Rocket or whatever, I would jump on the bus for a week at a time, or the van for a week at a time, if there was something important going on, or like we were in the midst of like going through demos or songs or anything. Like, I just always find it more appealing to be the guy on their level, to go in and really dig in, rather than to just call them every morning, you know?
Totally. So when was like the moment you kind of felt it starting to, I mean, you said the William project right. started to pick up, but was it once the Academy started going, when it was like, oh shit, stuff starting to change? Or yeah,
that was like the bigger turning point. Like the William part was really big, because it went from me selling like tens of records to hundreds of records, you know mm-hmm. what I mean? So it's like, so that was like a change all in itself of like, whoa, I think I kind of, and that was my fifth release. So that one, I immediately was like, whoa, okay, I could see how this would work on a larger scale if I had more of these types of sales numbers. So it kind of kept me motivated. And then, you know, the Academy is stuff, man. And it's funny, because when William told me and my partner, Tony, at the time, that he was starting a band and not doing Remember Maine anymore, we were like furious, because it was our first like decent seller.
Success, yeah.
You know what I mean? And I was like, so then he's like, dude, but just come over, like, listen to what we have. We wrote two songs. I'm like, you're quitting for two songs? Like, what are you doing? And then like, we went over and they played them literally three times in a row, over and over. And later that night, that was the Academy at the time. And later that night, we're like, all right, we're in, whatever you want, let's just do it. Literally went to my computer, printed out a new contract, and had them all sign it. Wow. So it was just like, you know, it was just this moment of like, oh, okay, you are looking at a bigger picture and all that. So right at that time, they were working on their record. I had signed Hidden in Plain View, which had a release out. I re-released it. And then, so that was happening, and they signed a drive-through immediately. So it was like, oh shit, now my bands are like going to bigger places, which a lot of people would, I don't know if they recommend against it, but like, I always thought like, if you just do the right thing with good people, a lot of more people are going to want you around. So I immediately wasn't trying to like lock bands down or anything wild like that. And then when I signed Academy Is and we put that out, we were selling a couple thousand, which again, jumping from a couple hundred yeah. to a couple thousand was immediately like, wow, we don't even have money to press another couple thousand, because that's a lot of money to press 4,000 records or whatever. Yeah. So yeah, that was them and Gatsby's at the same time was a really important lesson, because I dumped so much money into both of those bands at the exact same time. And, you know, when you would go through Smart Punk or distribution or whatever, you wouldn't see that money, even if it sold well, for like a year.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I was the guy with like $30,000 credit card debt, just because I believed in these bands. And then like, at the end, the last day of the label, I had $28,000 in LLR credit card debt. And everyone's like, dude, you killed it. That was the best. You probably made so much money. And I'm like, yeah. Not at all, I mean, but that's cool.
Which is like, you know, such a common like thread in people that end up like making it in doing this is just like willing to do anything. I mean, right. I remember Tim, our manager, my brother, for people that don't know, but like would like literally he would do anything. He was mm-hmm. printing shirts for bands, and he was like promoting shows and had a clothing company and would
paying for
like,
the record.
And yeah, he would just like mm-hmm. like pay for bands' albums that like he wasn't making any money on it. Yeah. Like he was just like doing whatever to like be a part of it. And like
right.
that's it takes that level of dedication to like break through. I mean,
right. Yeah. I mean, there was a moment right after we signed Academy that we reached out to Gatsby's American Dream on Instant Messenger just because we loved them. And we found Bobby from Gatsby's American Dreams, AIM handle, and we reached out and he was responding. And I'm like, what the fuck? Like, I thought they were such a big, like, yeah. you know, huge band at the time just because we loved them and they're on a national label. And like, we just got to be friends over a couple days. And he's like, yo, we're going to go record an EP. We would love to do it with you. And I was like, yeah, what the fuck? What are you talking about? You know what I mean? It made no sense. And we had literally just maxed out every credit card on the Academy record. And I went to my partner and was like, hey, we got to do this. He's like, dude, he was more of the money guy, like the smarter guy. and he very much was like, dude, it's impossible. You have to say no. I was like, this is one of our favorite bands. They want to be on our label. You don't say no to stuff like that. Like, we'll figure it out. We'll just figure it out. And we opened another credit card specifically to do it. And wow. I'm telling you, this is like credit card 5. It wasn't like third one. Yeah, you know what I mean? So it's like, I don't know how as 18-year-olds we were getting just like hand over fist credit cards. But, you know, it worked out. Now, but yeah, I mean, it just took every sort of like you're in your gut. You kind of were, I was like, I'm signing this band, whether you want to or not. So let's figure out how we're paying for it. And it's going to change the course of what we want to do. So yeah. It actually did. I mean, those guys are still friends of mine and really important pieces to the puzzle of, you know, my career. So and they've taught me a lot, too, because they were the first band I ever worked with that wasn't the strict pop format. Like they were so against choruses when I met them and really odd. So it kind of taught me another side of the world and, you know, really interesting guys.
Yeah. And then so then you go to working at Field by Ramen, you kind of go from being the guy that's in charge to, you know, to working for other people. What do you remember from like the early days? Because, I mean, I would imagine like right as you got there, I mean, all those bands were just blowing up. I mean, like Panic the Disco was putting out records and.
Yeah, it was probably the best time to ever get hired at any label in the history, I would say, for the sake of, like, you know, not even just our scene, just like going from 0 to 100 so fast and being there right at that moment. So, yeah, I mean, it was an interesting entry point just because I had a good history with John, the owner, because he signed two of my bands from LLR. So when he first signed August Premiere, I didn't have a contract with them, so they went freely. And then the Academy is, I had two more full length records in a contract with them. And
oh, wow.
I lived with the guys at the time and John came out and visited because him and I and the Fall Out Boy guys were all close. And Fall Out Boy, Pete was bringing them out and saying, hey, you got this band's opening for us. Why don't you come out to the show? I think it'd be good to get them on the label. So John came out, stayed with us at our apartment with Mike and William and then my partner Tony, and we just got to know each other really well. And he's like, look, I want to sign them. He's like, what's the deal? And I said, well, we got two records left, so like here I am thinking like I hit it rich. I'm like, oh man, he's gonna give me like $1 million, this is gonna be sick. I'm about to buy a house, this is great. It worked. Yeah. Everything worked. And then he's like, yeah, we don't do that. Like, we're not a big label. Like, Fall Out Boy was just starting to break off of Take This to Your Grave, and like I said, you know, all money in the music industry is like a good year delayed. So he's like,
yeah,
dude, we don't have any money. Like, we made that Fall Out Boy record for like $15,000. Like, there's nothing, we don't have like a bank account like that, you know? And I'm just like, so then like I got the guys in the band, you know, days later looking at me like, man, like, we got to come up with some sort of deal. Like, this is kind of the next step. And so I kind of like went through these crazy, like trying to find myself moments. And I was just like, man, these are my best friends. Like, I would much rather than me get a weird payday that have them succeed. So I sat with Tony and I was just like, we got to just tear up the deal. Like, it's the right thing to do. And he's just like, what do you mean? And I'm like, we just have to, that's the right thing. And we literally tore up the contract and we're like, you guys are free to go to FBR if you want. And they went obviously. And then, right at that time FBR was expanding very fast because the Fall Out Boy thing was happening and Pete was starting to bring them other bands. Gym Class had just signed. I think Paramore was happening right at that time, or at least in the beginning stages of figuring out songs for the record. Mm-hmm. And then, so they were expanding and it was very much just like, it worked out because John kind of saw our true colors, that he actually offered us both jobs pretty immediately. And to which the story gets weird, but we turned him down for a long time, like 4 months, just because we're like, we believed in our label so much, which is so funny looking back at the monster debt we had. And we're like, man, but like, we can go work with all our friends. Like, Academy's there, Gym Class is there, Fall Out Boy's there. Like, we got to just go. And then Tony wanted to be a tour manager and he still is to this day. And I was like, fuck it, I'm going. So then I went. And so, like I said, like, John and I had a good relationship. It wasn't just like I applied, got hired blindly. So he immediately just like threw me into my strengths. And, I learned so much from him. I wasn't even an A&R right away. I was just a retail and marketing guy. So I just literally did what I kind of told you, like, I'll just tell people about great bands. Like, that's immediately what I flew into.
Yeah. Then, I mean, like, you did something that like most people wouldn't do in any aspect of their life. It's like, you know, you just could have caused a huge problem and just said like, no, like, I have this band that's having success and I have two more records, a bunch of like money to be made there, you know. And I think like too many people are caught up in like what's happening right now as opposed to you looking at the big picture of what that meant for you. I mean, if you would have held them back, I'm sure the relationship with the band would have been pretty bad when they're watching all their friends get big on FBR and they're on their buddies' record label. You know?
Yeah, I can't even imagine making that second record with them with that tension. So, like, and honestly, maybe that played a huge part in it. I can't fully revisit the memory of it, but it's like, I'm sure I was like, dude, this is their opportunity and we're the ones. We two people will be the people standing in the way. Do you think our working relationship will not suffer from that? Like, it's impossible to ever get back to 6 months ago and the happiness and excitement. It's over. Like, that's just what it is. But let's do the right thing and everyone will eventually win from it. And Tony tour manages Panic at the Disco still to this day. So it's not like it didn't work out for him either. So.
Okay, you leave your own label, and then you go right into what is about to be the biggest label of the scene. Like, where's your head at? Like, what's it like?
It's
at
crazy.
The top, I guess.
Well, it wasn't immediately there, which was kind of awesome to like understand still like the label John described of like, you know, it was a small staff and, you know, we weren't like, it wasn't a glamorous thing whatsoever. And, you know, I just saw everything happening with all those bands and it was just exciting. Like, I was 21. Like, I can't imagine many 21-year-olds get to see that thing from the inside and learn from someone like John who, you know, obviously had crazy success and now runs Interscope, which is one of the biggest major labels ever. So it's like learning from that person at that time, like that's the best college anyone could ever have in the music industry by far. So it was crazy because the amount of records that would come out and the partnership with Pete Wentz at the time and all that other stuff, like the timing of all of it couldn't have been done better. And with every record, we would like break the record we had just set with the previous release, you know? So it was one of those things where we were just trying to figure out the funnel of, you know, there's so much excitement. There's so many big different fan bases, and we were just trying to funnel them all into an FBR brand. And I think did it pretty delicately, but like obviously with the help of all of the bands and, you know, the mouthpieces of all those bands spoke so highly of the label and the family vibe and all of that stuff. So I think it was just like a whirlwind. And, you know, I lived in Tampa for 2.5 years, and working side by side with all those people was just unbelievable, because we were all kids except for John. I mean, John I don't even think he's 40 yet, which is crazy. So he wasn't even that, like, he wasn't like a seasoned veteran. It was his first thing he ever did in music. So we were all learning as we went, and it was just crazy. I mean, it was like numbers we had never seen. And like I said, we were just breaking records, and nothing was normal. It was always just like the next step was like crazier than the last step that was crazy at that point, you know?
Yeah. I mean, like what a time period. I mean, going, I mean, the Academy starts getting big, and then Panic the Disco just freaking explodes.
Yeah.
Like were you guys just like amazed by it? Like
oh, yeah.
I mean, you guys took over
MTV.
Yeah, it's like...
Yeah, there was a TRL day. That was amazing.
It's like, how do you comprehend that? Like, did it feel like things were going insane? Or, I mean, like when that Panic record, like started to explode, did it...
Right.
Was it hard to keep up?
Like, oh, my God. Dude, literally, yes, because... That record, we had no idea how many records to make, because the band had never released a song before for sale, you know? And that was, I think it was before iTunes. Yeah, it had to be, because, yeah, we were doing so many physical units at the time, and it was web store and distribution and tour or whatever. But yeah, that Panic record, dude, like, we didn't know what it was going to be, because all you could judge is like MySpace stats, but we didn't know how that translated to sales, because they hadn't released, they didn't release an EP. They came out of the gate with the full length. So we had no idea what to do. And that is the week of release, John went to Italy to get married and have his honeymoon for 2 weeks, right at the beginning of it. And this was my first release. There was like a GM right above us. And then, but he was a kid too. He wasn't like, you know, he'd never seen anything like it. And I was the retail guy. So that was the first record that came out. And I don't know what we pressed. We pressed 20,000 units or something, you know, nothing crazy by the standard of what you think that band is. And we got a call from Best Buy, I want to say at noon on the East Coast, and they said, we're sold out of everything, we need more. And we it was like 3 hours into the doors being open, and that's on the East Coast. And we were like, oh shit. And I was like, and I'm the guy. I have to be the guy that orders more. But John's overseas, the time difference, he's not awake right now. So everyone at our distribution company is like, you have to green light like 50,000 copies of this like today in order to get them in the stores by the end of this week. And I'm like, I can't. That's so much money. Like, I can't make that call. Like, dude, this is literally in your hands. You have to figure it out. And I'm like, there's no possible way I'm making this call. So I had to call. We had just started working with Atlantic Records on like a friend basis while they were figuring out whatever, you know, subsidiary thing would happen. So I made a weird cold phone call over to there and just said, hey, I'm in a really weird pickle. I need this to be figured out. I'm the guy. I feel like I'm going to get fired if I do this, because if I do it and we don't sell any, I'm fucked. And management's like calling me and asking me when I'm green lighting it. Is everything cool? And then the guy's just like, you'd be insane not to. You have to do it. Trust me. It's fine. With the numbers they're reporting right now, like, you're fine. And I ultimately did it. So it doesn't sound as scary knowing what the band is now. But what if their East Coast following was just crazy?
Yeah.
And then here I am like quadrupling the order with a button, you know, and it worked out obviously, but it was like a 2 hour period where I was like, I'm not equipped for this. You know what I mean? Like, this is above my pay grade and my boss isn't here. I don't know what to do. And it was
adult.
Dude, I was, yeah. And I literally did that and called Atlantic, and they were like, done. You have to do it right now. Don't wait any longer. You'll screw it up, you know? So, but yeah, that was the moment that I was like, this is insane. And like, we're literally learning new things every day, because you just have to make these crazy, as educated as possible, but you know, they're crazy decisions. So yeah. You'd see that. I mean, even when Keto's What We Aim For came out, like, again, that was all MySpace. So we're like, we don't know what this is going to be. And it, at the time, I think it came out right before Panic, and it like broke the record for the biggest Fuel by Ramen first week ever at the time. And it was like 13,000 copies or something, but that was such an absurd number for a band. Yeah. And they did, I feel like they played a couple shows, or I don't even remember where they were in the, but like MySpace and MTV just like picked up on them somehow and it worked.
Yeah. That's insane.
Yeah.
So then, as you know, as all this kind of happens and like that momentum and success just continues, you know, for the next couple of years, it just continues to go insane. And then you transition into being an A&R guy there. Did it feel like, I mean, you had to have kind of had a little bit of an easier time like convincing bands to come to the label.
Absolutely.
than other things, because it's like who wouldn't want to be a part of that? Because like people were thinking like, I signed a Fuel by Ramen, I am automatically on MTV, I'm automatically huge, which obviously isn't necessarily the case.
Sure.
But I mean, was that?
Yeah, I don't. Felt? Like, yeah, absolutely. It was very rare that, you know, the pitch was a lot easier because you could point to a lot of, you know, case studies of like, you know, hey, this is what you do on tour. These are the bands we would try to get you with. These are the things. And like, you could map out a road pretty quickly. So it was ultimately like, we, you know, I don't, there's not a lot of cases where it was like, oh man, we didn't get that band or whatever. I mean, outside of your band, but you know,
whatever. But I remember you coming into the show in Chicago, and I was like,
on our first tour, our first ever tour.
There was ever, like our last show, and with the Morning Light and Brighton,
yeah.
And you coming, and I knew you were coming, and I was fucking freaking. I was like, dude, the Fuel by's coming. This is insane. And maybe we had kind of talked about it
just through Tim, maybe, because I think Tim and I were kind of, you know, just internet buddies at the time, but I don't think I had ever met Tim at that point.
Yeah, like, but I remember after the show, like, you'd be like, oh, that was cool. And I was like, oh, shit, we're fucked.
Which is amazing. But because I remember going home and, like, on the way home calling John and being like, yeah, we gotta do this. It's great. Everything's cool.
Which is, like, you know, looking back now, like, for us to have not done that, you know, to not sign to Fuel by Ramen when we had, you know, the opportunity was crazy at the time, you know? I mean, like, obviously it, like, worked out okay for us, but...
Absolutely.
I mean, I remember, I mean, it was like you were talking to Tim and working on it, and then Sean from Acute was... I mean, he would call me. I mean, I remember...
Dude!
The night that I lost my virginity in a drive-in movie theater, like right before the movie, I'm getting a call from John Janik and from Sean, and they're just like, because they had heard that we were like probably gonna go with Bob signed to Fearless, and they're just like trying to see like what they could do to like to change our minds, and I'm just like, dude, I'm like freaking 17 years old. Like, what?
I remember being on a date right now.
Like, I'm just trying to have sex.
Like, I remember being in your room, and it was like, it felt like.
Wait,
we
it
had,
was with you? What the?
No. when we actually figured out, it was like we were all at Pat's house, and it was like, it felt like coming down to the minutes. Like,
it was.
Bob's like, I'm going to pull this in like 5 minutes if you don't say yeah.
And then, I remember that, yeah.
And then you guys were like, no, we're going to pull it in 2 minutes. And it was like, what the fuck, man? I'm a little kid. Yeah. I don't know what to do.
We made a checklist of like the pros and cons of like every record label, and
you guys lost. I'm sorry.
I know. I was gonna say, give me that checklist. We could have known what we needed to improve on.
I know. And like, I really don't know what it was.
I think it
was because Bob told us that you guys are going to be the only band I'm gonna sign this entire year,
right?
And like, you're gonna be my focus. And like, we
That's
were just
what
like,
it was.
We're yeah, like, oh. And that's hard to deny, especially I'm friendly with Bob, and I like him, and I like the label, so I very much can understand that move, and if that rang true, I mean, clearly they did a lot for your band at the time, so I can't even say that you made a wrong decision by any means, because clearly we're still here talking.
Yeah. So,
but
yeah, you know what's
it was
so
crazy. Yeah,
what's so crazy about that time period? You know, so this is like 2007, I guess, you know, 2008. And so this is kind of like coming down a bit on, you know, Panic and Fall Out Boy and Paramore and Gym Class and all this success. And all those bands kind of came out of like an underground scene, you know, where they're playing in basements to know people. And then all of a sudden they're huge, you know. And then the bands that were coming out, which I guess now people call
neon,
like the neon era, the MySpace era, right. Whatever. You know, a lot of, you know, kind of crappy bands came out of that time because some awesome ones as well. But you know what the difference was is like bands were able to see that it was possible to be on the radio, to be in arenas, to be on MTV. And I think that totally changed the culture of bands, like in our scene, you know?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, in a lot of them, you know, you could see the scenes and the tides completely change. But yeah, I mean, even like Cobra Starship coming out at that time, like Gabe coming from Midtown and, you know, he just wanted to kind of do this like fun project that did the Snakes on a Plane song. And then next thing you know, that song's kind of on the radio. So he's like, well, shit, you know, now I got to make a record and, you know, and had a lot of radio success after that. And yeah, I think that they all came from a place of, you know, integrity and like trying to do something, you know, either fun or like very, you know, the artist in them, or they just wanted to grow the scene. I don't know. It was a very interesting time. Yeah. Where, yeah, I mean, a lot of those bands, shit, there were so many really bad ones, obviously, that, like, we're getting smashed by every lawyer and manager to sign every one of those. But you can kind of see the ones that were just like, oh, you're, like, in your late 20s trying to wear neon now, touring with late teens. Like, this is getting strange here. You're just trying to cash in at the end of your run. So, but there was a lot that I thought, you know, that stuff was interesting because, I mean, even you guys obviously kind of caught a tail of that, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like, I mean, yeah, I mean, you're, I guess your beginning era and like what All Time Low and like Boys Like Girls and stuff like that was kind of touching in and out of that for the first couple records. I mean, the first record for you guys, but, you know, that whole era, most of them stayed and you guys did your own thing, which was, you know, more interesting than most of their careers. But yeah, I think that. That there was actual scenes though, man. Like I don't know. Does it? I feel like it does exist in a somewhat of a small pop punk way at this point, but
yeah,
kind of
I mean, a
cool club more than anything.
Yeah, I mean, like to me, what the biggest like difference is, and what makes it hard, like what makes it harder now, I think for bands to have success than it was for us. You know, is it was like, you know, we had such a carved out path where it was like, all right. We play on the Warped Tour. We are in AP Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
We are sponsored by Snakes and Suits and Glamour Kills. And we're on Absolute Punk. And
yeah.
So it was like you like knew exactly where to go to reach the audience that you wanted to reach, which is why like the scene was so strong.
Yeah, you're right. I guess there were better, like maybe stronger foundations in each facet of where you needed to go. Like if it was press, it was like alt press, it was Absolute Punk. Those were like the two things that you had to just be liked by Mike Shea and Jason Tate, and it would work really well. And if it didn't, you would kind of struggle through the forums or the premieres or whatever you would get out of them.
Yeah.
And you know, like, and the Warped Tour was always like, it's going to be crazy because like with this one being the last one, it's like the fact that, you know, every meeting I've ever been in was always like you used Warped Tour as like a launch point or like a second phase or whatever it is. Like you used it in your marketing plans, literally, you know? So it's crazy that like those things, I mean, that's how it was for Bamboozle and stuff too. We were like announcing band signings at Bamboozle at one point, cause it was so like sought after.
Yeah.
It was like, we would literally pass out like postcards and samplers with the first time we ever mentioned that we signed this band or their new record got announced that day or whatever it was. It was like these really interesting flagpoles that like now kind of, again, it's really noisy. So it's like, I don't know where, like, what would that even be for people like now? And it, for that scene, there really isn't that thing.
No, I mean, yeah, there's not. And like, that's what makes it so hard, where like now I think bands that are coming up right now, it's harder to like find your place, because it's like, where do you go to find that? And you know, it's going to be really interesting. And I, you know, I'd be interested to hear your perspective on like, once the like Warped Tour ends, you know, I mean, I think there's a lot that's going to change. I mean, like, there's a lot of bands that base their touring around that one specific tour.
Right. Yeah, and I don't know if someone's going to try to create anything or even smaller than it in its place or something, which would obviously be helpful, but very hard to do, clearly.
Totally.
Yeah. I think that would be the biggest problem with it, is, like, that thing's so run so tight, and it has for 20 whatever years. Like, it's like, I don't think you could just come in and nail it the first time. And
of course. Exactly. And I think that, like, obviously showing that it didn't work. You know what I mean? Like, it faded, however, whatever reasonings. But I don't know, man. It's I don't know if that scene will ever, I don't want to say ever, because at the time it was just so vibrant and there were so many pockets of it. I mean, I guess Drive Thru did it, you know, years before Fuel By did it too, where they...
Yeah.
Kind of had to create their own scene, like they did too, because it branched off. It was kind of the more, you know, pop centric side of the pop punk at the time, where it could be played on the radio, and they had to create like their own thing from the ground up because no other label or no other scene or label was participating. And then eventually they had their own stage at Warped, but beyond that, it was like those bands, you got to like find a way to make them into headliners. You know, basic, I guess, you know, as you guys are feeling now, like it feels like the thing where there's not going to be as many launching pads, like you're saying. And I don't think anything solves that. I think it's just, you know, with the social media, the way it is, it's just the more like actual accountable, like contact with fans, you know, and like, again, showing the stuff that you guys do, and you know, you show up and you actually care about shit. That's step one. And you know, so it's like doing things to document that in a way where it's not cheese ball shit and not going, you know, to, you know, sick kids homes just to film it and then get out of there and hate it. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like doing things for the right reasons, I think will always elevate the bands and put you under a microscope in a really positive way.
Yeah. Do you feel like now when you're signing bands compared to maybe in, you know, 2007, 8, 9, that there's a shift in, you know, like coming off of, like I was saying, you know, like, you know, bands that were coming up the time of us, you know, had all these big ambitions because it felt like it was possible to be on MTV or to be on the radio. Where like now, that doesn't necessarily feel as possible. Do you think that's kind of like changed mentalities of bands like right now?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because a lot of the bands, so yes and no. I guess some bands, yes, absolutely. And some bands, like, there's, you know, a bunch of different little scenes right now that are like very much back to the basements and like fuck corporate America and all this other stuff. So it's like,
which is awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting because it's like, those are cool. And that's where it all kind of started, and the energy that all of us built careers off of came from. So I think that, you know, watching that grow again, and then those bands, when they hit their ceiling within that little world, that's when they're more open to like, oh man, like, and it only takes a band or two to like step out of that normal, you know, route and to start something new, to where then it becomes this like, oh, okay, they did it. It's cool. You know what I mean? Like, it's just a kind of tough thing to where I think that you just got to find the right bands and artists. And I'll meet with some artists still that are just like, no, I want to be the biggest band in the world by any means necessary. Like, let's figure out a way to do it, you know? So it's like, that's still there, but it's not as obvious to them, like the paths. Cause like bands like Fall Out Boy or Panic or whatever, those bands are like just big bands to them. They don't remember the, like
how it happened. Yeah.
So, and it's hard because not a lot of bands these days are, you know, I guess, I don't know, they're not documenting, but I guess those bands didn't either, but we saw it different ways, like behind the scene DVDs or whatever you saw, and you just watched the growth. But I think that a lot of bands today just aren't seeing the growth because a lot of bands aren't talking about it. You know what I mean? Or it's just not happening as often or as easily as you and I got to watch.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it felt like, you know, like that was such an interesting time because there was just so many bands that were coming to success like pretty quickly and were able to like grow these audiences. And it felt like it was just getting like huge, like again, you know, even right. in our era, like I'm, you know, I know me and you talked about it the other day where it's like, you know, like Never Shout Never, you know, right. it's like all these, like the rumors, the numbers that you heard of, like, you know, how much Chris got for his record deal and all this stuff. It's just like, it was just, people were just wanting to be a part of this world, you know? And
it was
just
like a gold rush. It was really weird.
Yeah. And, but like, I mean, like what an exciting time to be a part of the music industry. Like,
yeah, it was great. And what's funny is like everyone that I met at that time was telling me that I had just missed it. Like it was already not as good as the previous 10 years. And which, I mean, obviously if you look at numbers overall, sure. But at the time, like going from basements to selling tens to hundreds to thousands, you know, to millions of records at one point, it's like, it's a crazy thing to watch. And, you know, again, I could go back though, like all those bands that had a lot of success, I can pinpoint it to like something that they did or from early conversations that I had with them, just to know that they were like, this was it, like this is their life and they're doing it. Totally. And it's not just like a band, but they're also doing this and they're also doing that. Like it's just, it's not, I don't know, maybe it is like that still. It's with some bands I see it and with some bands I don't. I mean, obviously I still sign bands, so I sign the ones I think still do that and speak to me that way. And I just, you know, if an artist is willing to kind of like bend over, put it all on the line nonstop, it's like, that's the artist that you can bet on forever.
Yeah. I mean, and I think that's kind of the common like thread and, you know, having these conversations with people is like you are like, you were willing to go into as much debt as possible to do something that you completely believed in, you know, and it worked. And then there's bands, you know, and like us, I mean, we were willing to drop everything. I mean, there's nothing that I wouldn't have done and there's nothing I wouldn't do now to like continue to do what we do. Cause I just love being a part of this. I love being a part of music. Like
I think that's the spark though, that can't go. If you have that thing, I don't know if it really ever burns out.
Yeah,
like,
I mean, like some people get like jaded and burnt out on it, you know, it happens often, you know?
Yeah. But I'm saying, like, if it's truly there, I don't know. Cause I mean, look at us. Yeah. I mean, we still want to do things every day. Like if we're not doing stuff, we start to freak out.
Yeah.
So like, I think if it truly, truly is there, then I don't know. I don't think it does. And that's why there's not some bands around still that came up with this, you know?
Yeah, and maybe there's different levels of it. I mean, like, you guys are more of the most ambitious, and, like, I can tell that, like, you don't sit at home for months and months on end, you know what I mean? Like, and just do nothing. Like, you're doing this, or you're doing writing your record or whatever you're doing in the meantime. But I mean, dude, there's a lot of bands that go home and they're like, oof, that was tough. And they like, can't wait to not think about their band for a couple months. You know what I mean? So I think there's just varying levels of, you know, not maybe how badly you want it, but maybe how you're also programmed and educated on what it is you're trying to achieve. You know, maybe no one's ever told them that it's achievable, you know? So it's like, there's got to be that positive, record.
Yeah. Which is like one of the most exciting like things about doing the podcast is like hearing, you know, people like to be able to see that, like, you are like now, you know, you're an A&R guy at, you know, one of the biggest record labels, you know, a major record label. And like, you you were just a fan of bands. Right. You were on the street team. You were like, and you just kept working at it. I mean, that's all that that's
exactly
all that, that's all that, that we are. That you know, and like I feel like people put everybody up on this pedestal and don't understand that like these are just people that are fans, just like anybody else, and just yeah. had a passion and just ran with it.
Right. I mean, any successful person in music can pinpoint to the first bands that they fell in love with that made them want to do it, or story, or anything like that. Like, so, like with you guys, you grew up during the drive-thru era, so you were probably just like Newfound Glory. Oh my God! Yeah. Like, yeah, we yeah. have to, yeah. we got to figure out a way to be that. I want to be on stage. That looks so fun. All they're doing is touring with their friends, messing around. And yeah. you were just not by any means necessary. You're like, I'm going to do that. And here you are 12, 13, whatever it is, years later, still ripping, you know? So I think it's just, you know, showing people that like finding that like energetic, like moment. And then also then having someone in front of you or being naive enough to not understand it, to just, you try really hard. But a lot of people stop because they're like, oh, someone's already doing this and they're better than me at it. So fuck it. You know, yeah. like, but like, think if like Fuelbar Ram didn't start because Drive Thru was already signing the bands we wanted to sign. Like, yeah. it'd be crazy. But that's a real mentality, because a lot of people don't have that positive influence. So even you guys doing this, telling your stories, telling other people's stories on there, I think can hopefully just like grab someone that's like stuck somewhere, you know, and been like, oh fuck it, just keep going, or figure yeah. out what it is that actually drives you, or something that'll make you happy. Like, it's well, just,
I think that's a huge thing, is maybe people, it's hard to get, like, you have to get the clouds out of your mind, where it's like, right. maybe the thing that you think you want really isn't that. And that's not the thing that excites you. That's why mm-hmm. you're not going to do it. You know, like,
right.
I think a lot of it is searching and trying things and doing a whole lot. And then you stumble upon the thing that you actually do enjoy and do really want to do. And then that's the thing you're going to keep going.
Yeah.
Cause that's the thing that, you know, gets your rocks off, you know, like,
yeah.
Like,
and you know, like when you were, you know, you were working at Fuelbar, and then that ended. And then you, I mean, just like the fact of like the persistence and the love that you've had for this, like then to build up a management company, you know, so you're like beginning again from nothing,
yeah.
and you build up this huge thing. I mean, like, was there ever a time when you were like, maybe I'm just done with this? Like,
no, not even a thought. Yeah. Like, immediately when I left Fuelbar, like the end of that day, I got on the phone with like five or six producers and was managing them, like, immediately within 24 wow. hours. So it was just like something that I was like, I love this. This is one of my favorite parts about making records and signing bands. I want to do the other side of it now, because I understand now what labels expect and bands expect and all this other stuff. So it was a really easy transition. But no, it never was like, oh man, I gotta pack it up and go back and get a job that I probably don't like now. Like, it was just not yeah. that at all. It was immediate into like, I want to work for myself. I don't want anyone to ever dictate my income or my career or anything. So I want to build a foundation. So, I mean, much what you guys are clearly doing as well. And like I now at that end, on that end of my life, like, I literally do, you know, I built a company with all my friends. Like, it's just all friends that I manage, and it's really easy, and it means a lot, because if they don't work, they don't eat, and their families suffer. So it's on me. You know what I mean? So it's like, yeah. it's a fun accountability to put on myself, to put pressure. And it was a lot to grow it, but I'm 5.5 years deep on it. I mean, and just like you mentioned, Snakes and Suits, I have a new clothing company called Good Future Club that I started from zero like 6 months ago. And it's like, to me, my wife and I just wanted to make a positive impact and do something that was like fun and include the music industry, because that's where obviously we're both raised through it. And immediately it was just like, let's start from zero. Who gives a shit? And let's yeah. just have fun with it and put stuff out in the world that we think can hopefully spark some good thoughts or some good vibes. And that's kind of where that went. So it was like, starting from zero is not scary, as long as you actually want to do something. It's more or less like, it's the people
exciting.
That have,
I mean, dude, it's like,
it could shape a whole new thing. It's awesome. Like, yeah. I don't know what any of it's going to become, but I'm like, having fun with it.
Like, as much as I love being in the main, and I think that we're going to do it for a long time, you know, and I, you know, like my goal is that like we outlast every band that we've ever
that's gone great.
On a tour with. But yeah. at the same time, like there's also something really exciting about like if for some yeah. reason like it just ended tomorrow to like do it all again, you know,
yeah, and to take to everything just, like, you learned,
just
good and
prove
bad,
that you can do it, you know,
yeah, like exactly. And that's just, and it, what's funny is like that's the thing that drives it to where if you actually want to do it, it's you control it, but yeah. it's, I mean, it's the same. I heard it the other day and I loved it. It was like someone that's like, something about working out or like New Year's resolutions was like, you make these unrealistic like settings to where it'd be like, I have to work out 7 days in a row. That's it. Simple. And you don't do it. So you immediately quit and never work out for another yeah. month. You know what I mean? So it's like these people that just like have to figure out their whole career when they're 18 years old. And then they freak out when it doesn't work out. It's like, just go do anything. Go do anything and everything yeah. and do stupid shit. Do fun yeah. shit. Like, do anything and just yeah, I mean, have fun the whole time.
You know, like, if, you know, I would imagine it kind of goes like this, the same for you is like, you know, you have all these big ambitions and you have to aim really big and you end up, you like, every single time you don't quite hit where you thought, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, it you're always, you know, in my mind, you know, our band was going to be in arenas, you know?
Right.
And like, I still think that could happen, you know?
Agreed.
But we're on a different path to like get there, you know? So you really have to love the process of doing this, not just the end goal of,
exactly.
of what you're doing, or you're not going to ever be happy because, you know, there's been times in our band where like, it got kind of freaky, you know, it was like, not as many people are coming to the shows, not, you know,
yeah.
and you just have to like that to me was just like more exciting. Like, all right, well, let's figure this out. Let's
yeah.
keep it going.
Well,
there's nothing else I want to do. Like, I'm not going
to
quit.
You know, it's right. if you fall off the bull, you can't be afraid to get back on. I
yeah.
think that's like, you know, it's like. As much as that hurt your ego,
yeah.
it's like, no, I'm down to get back on that thing and just get
over
rocked
and
some
over,
more.
or go to a different bowl. You know what
yeah,
I mean? Like,
yeah,
dude, just
yeah,
like
totally.
Try so many different things, and it's like you just gotta find the one that like you're gonna do whether there's success or not. That's the thing that you need to find. Because that's the thing that you're going to do when it gets really hard or you're broke or you're going into debt or whatever. And then if it is good, and I mean, obviously the quality has to be there on some level to where, you know, then you get to hopefully surround yourself with really good people and keep working towards the bigger goal, whatever that may be. And whatever, it's just, it's got to be a drive though. And it has to be exciting to you or else you'll find a way to not do it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, yeah, it's one of those things. It's like you either really love it or you don't. You
know? Yeah. It's well, pretty simple. We watched a lot of bands, obviously, all the three of us come and go how many times, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm sure we could make a list of bands that we all immediately thought weren't going to make it that broke up a year later, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just, exactly. It's something you can kind of sometimes understand just by conversation or being around or seeing the lack thereof be put into any of it.
Yeah. Well, I'm excited to for us to both continue to be doing this for another 15 years and have this conversation again. And
it's weird not seeing
years,
you in Chicago
yeah.
anymore. And
I know.
And you're in LA.
it's a different beast, but now I get to bring my daughter out, so it's kind of yeah. more fun.
Yeah.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
Well, thanks for taking the time to talk, and I'm so pumped for people to continue to see what, you know, what exciting things that you bring to our music scene, because there's not that many people, you know, left that have this much of a passion for what they're doing. So.
Awesome. Well, thank you, and I could say the same about you guys and what you do and what you bring. So, you know, keep doing it, and we'll keep listening, I guess, right?
Yeah. Hell yeah, man. Well, thanks so much.
Cool. Awesome, we'll be good, dudes.
Thanks
for chatting.
Alrighty.